Autre radio, autre culture, bonjour. Audio People et Autre radio, autre culture vous présentent les deuxièmes rencontres de la création sonore qui se sont déroulées au SAE Institute de Paris les 26 et 27 mai 2010. Bonne écoute.
Alors la conférence va être évidemment en anglais, donc Terry Nelson et moi-même qui serons donc les modérateurs de cette conférence sommes également à votre disposition pour aider à la traduction ou d'une question ou d'une réponse. I would like to thank very much our colleague Jean-José Vanek to have provided us with this wonderful transparent production that he did. He's been scanning Beatles material for weeks and he generated this the previous slideshow that you have seen. May I just introduce the people who will be here? So first one, Dave Harris. So Dave Harris is working with British Grove. Used to run some technical sides of EMI and was a colleague of Jeff in the early times. We had dinner tonight and they told a lot of jokes that they were doing together when they were at EMI. That's not in Jeff's book.
But
so next to Dave, there is another Dave Stewart, who is. So who is British Grove Studio Managing Director and Technical Director. British Grove, for people who do not know, is the studio owned by guitar player Mark Knopfler and Mr. Emmerich. I don't think it's necessary to introduce you. And the panel will be chaired, moderated, what you name it. My dear friend and colleague, Terry Nelson. Let's go.
I think it's the Dave and Dave show. Who will now, I'm sure, give us a very interesting overview of the creation, development, and current status of British Grove Studios.
Some of you who were maybe at the AES in Paris a few years ago may have seen some of these, I warn you now, because we did this a similar presentation there. Briefly, we put the studio together. It was completed in 2004-05, started in the year 2000. It was quite an adventure. I'd never built anything on that scale before. Dave had, obviously, which is why I got him in to be my right-hand man, let's say, and walk me through the process. So, first of all, obviously, we had to find a premises, and that led us a merry dance around London looking for a suitable place to put a studio, given that the only brief we had was to build a studio that was big enough to have a band and record them all at one time. Which, as you probably agree, is not exactly the best technical specification that you could have. So, but on the other hand, we had largely we could do sort of what we wanted. These are some of the buildings we looked at. If you can make them out, but that's the keen-eyed among you might spot. That's the old Decca Studios, which at the time we were looking was coming up for sale. Although we weren't allowed to go inside it and have a look, which was a shame.
That's the old Broadhurst Gardens studio that Decca used in the days, at the same time that we were at Abbey Road in the 60s and the 70s, before it became the base of the English National Opera. And apparently all the studios and the rooms are still complete in there, but unfortunately they weren't in a position where, although it says outside all inquiries and for sale, they weren't in a position to move. So we moved on from there and looked at other buildings, such as the water pumping station off the A4 in Chiswick, actually, funnily enough. And because our brief also was to be to the west of London if we could, because it was, you know, within commuting distance for Mark and most of the musicians, and in fact round Chiswick most of the record companies used to be there. So that was another place we looked at. It was a very large building and would have been ideal, but they didn't want to really give us the bit of space that we wanted, and anyway the project looked a long way off. So we carried on looking, and
we found these boat sheds, which were on the river, which had we thought was a fantastic location. But in the end, we settled for the place we are now, and that's the building we found. It looked like very much, of course.
But it wasn't very much.
It wasn't very much.
High walls in the roof. Rain was coming in. It was a book warehouse, children's books warehouse, and it was in pretty poor state, and suddenly it came onto the market. We'd seen it once and turned it down because there were people in there, but then it came on the market, so we got it. Previously, it had been at one time the Island Record Store as well, so Island Records were just over the road, and the old Island Studios were just over the road in the old Chiswick Laundry, which is still there. It's a listed building, so we were close by there.
So this was the interior of the building, and as you can see, we got straight to work, putting tape on the floor and deciding how we were going to lay out the building. And in fact, where Dave is standing is actually where the listening position and the final studio ended up being. It's quite extraordinary, really. We went to all sorts of lengths. This was a mock-up of how we thought the windows would be to get an idea of sight lines into the studio, because we realised we were going to have to build a series of booths as well as have the double height space. So that was it, and we moved from that phase into some more detailed planning and laying out the building. You can see we designed those two studios. We've actually got two control rooms. The bigger studio, which is the red space, the live areas, that's the double height bit. And we realised that if we put the control room on a slant, we'd get very good sight lines to all parts of the studio, so you can get an idea of all the musicians. Don't have any hiding place. And that's the rest of the building, the other spaces upstairs and all that kind of stuff.
We managed to squeeze quite a bit of volume in the roof, although the roof originally went up and down, two triangles. We actually bridged across, which meant then the architects got us another floor in the middle there as well.
Yeah.
So we got quite a bit of space out of the original building. We retained the three outer walls, the back and the two end walls, and the front wall was demolished, and we rebuilt everything inside the existing shell, just keeping the three walls, basically, and the same roof height, because planning says, you know, you have to be within the same height that you were.
And that's the drawing of the three-dimensional drawing of the steelwork that went in, huge amount of steelwork, because every room, every technical room, is a room in its own right. It has its own structure, floors. Floors are all floated in the technical areas, as you'll see in a few other pictures. And that meant a tremendous amount of work in the ground, even before we started. There's something like 56 piles they had to dig down into the ground. The lift shaft, which we had to have a lift to get the tape machines up to the technical area, they went down 20 metres, the piles for that. It was quite extraordinary. And a lot of beams went down, and the reason for all of that, apart from the technical rooms, was we wanted to have a completely flat environment, no thresholds on the stairs, so if you've got stuff rolling through, it's not going to get bumped and all that kind of thing. So that's sort of the reason for it. But you can see there's a massive amount of
some of that steel structure is actually floating on rubber pads, so the actual steels come down to the ground,
and then they're sleeved bolts.
You
can see them sort of here.
Sleeved bolts, and then the pads sit on the slab. So those steels that are there attached to walls and ceilings and things don't actually touch the floor slab, because we were going to also put in a floating floor slab on top of that existing one.
That was a tremendous amount of work of a non-technical nature, making sure that the builders didn't stack all that with rubble and defeat the whole purpose of the isolation.
Yes, guess who had to grovel around taking all the cement and concrete off the bits? Guess who that was?
Okay, so this... Sorry? So this picture here demonstrates the structure that you're actually looking at the front of what's going to be the control room from high level, and you can see the two layers of slab. The lower layer is the roof of the control room, and the upper layer is the floor for the first floor, so they don't actually touch. None of these technical rooms are going to end up touching any other room for the purpose of isolation, and again, Dave was the monitor for that, to make sure that didn't...
We weren't near a tube line or anything like that. There wasn't any intrinsic rumble in the ground, and we actually didn't need to do it at the time, but, you know, for future-proofing a studio, really, particularly in a big city like we've got, or certainly in Paris with the metro and everything, it's worthwhile doing. It costs a bit more to start with, but at least you're guaranteed for the next 100 years in the future that you're not going to have any problems with isolation. The main thing is when you've got builders who don't really understand what you're doing, because they're used to steel and concrete, they don't appreciate the fact that these things have got to be kept separate and floating. And so you have to police them, like there, for example. You've got to chip that bit of stone and work away from round that steel there. because it's touching. So things like that, you know, they don't appreciate, and you just have to watch them like a hawk.
Could I just make a comment here?
Yes.
I'll speak in French because other.
Oui, bon. Merci.
Je ne peux pas souligner assez l'importance, même comme beaucoup de choses, c'est tellement évident, mais c'est surprenant les fois que c'est oublié, que quand vous êtes dans une situation de trouver le bon endroit pour un studio, ce qui n'est vraiment pas chose facile, parce que tous les projets que moi j'ai fait en Suisse, c'est le dernier endroit où on mettrait un studio. Mais le moment que vous avez trouvé le bon endroit, que le plus de pré-planning possible, ça vous éviterait énormément de temps et de frais plus tard. Donc ici, on a un exemple presque classique. On a fait beaucoup de pre-planning, on teste, on voit. Comme ça, on a le moment qu'on commence la construction, ça va aller le plus régulièrement possible. Évidemment, il y a toujours les choses de dernière minute, mais là, on fait étape, pas moitié heure. Il n'y a pas assez d'hauteur de plafond. Ah, je n'ai pas vu qu'il y avait un conduit qui passe dessus le marché et tout ça.
Some of the areas we encountered quite difficult structural problems to resolve. This is not a picture of the fourth bridge. It's actually what we had to do in order to have one of our booths, our long booths, free of pillars, because we wanted to be able to open the space out. The structural engineers saw the plans and said, right, well, we'll put pillars here and here. And I went, actually, no. The idea is that it's got to be a free space. So they scratched their heads until I said, well, you better put a bridge section up. That way you can span it. But it actually required two, because there's obviously one in the recording area side and there's one in the building side to keep, you know, the rest of the building out of the booth. So that there it is. And of course, the thing is, in the final analysis, nobody ever sees it. It just looks like a plain wall. But behind it is quite a story. There was a lot of conversation and planning had to go into doing that.
In actual fact, they built a wall on the front of that piece there.
Yeah.
And they built a wall along there. And the steel actually angled like that, bent with the weight of the block work. Mm. And so they had to put a block in at the top to stop the wall falling over, because when they finished, the wall wasn't vertical. So that was a bit of fun.
And plenty of steel and concrete. I mean, it went on for quite a long time, but it did create space for a mass of, let's say, plant air conditioning equipment, because we wanted from the outset to have the building not only air conditioned but climate controlled. So that means you've got to introduce humidity or dehumidify if it's very humid, as the climate conditions dictate. And you must have lots and lots of ducts, which are huge, because you need to have silencers in them, because the specification, I think, for the recording areas was NR15?
Yeah, NR15, Terry, do you want to explain that? And NR20 for the studio, for the control rooms.
Oui, donc, spécification donc, pour le bruit ambiant est très, très, très serré. Donc, ils avaient un chiffre de NC15. Donc, ça veut dire que le moment que les portes fermées, vous pouvez très bien entendre un moustique voler.
Il faut savoir que le studio est dans un endroit de Londres très, très, très bruyant, tout à côté d'un accès d'autoroute pour aller sur M4, aéroport de Heathrow. Et donc, dehors, on ne vivrait pas. Les maisons qui sont autour, je ne comprends pas comment les gens peuvent habiter là. Donc, dans le studio, on entre complètement dans une pièce bien isolée. I was mentioning the area, which is very noisy, beside
yes,
there,
yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I wouldn't like to have a flat there or a house there. I wouldn't take opportunity of the garden at no time.
Yeah, well, as part of the study we did several studies, one of which was a 48-hour noise measurement. We stuck mics on the roof and recorded them for 48 hours and had a look. So we had an idea of what the ambient noise level was going to be like. And likewise, we did the same, which we'll touch on for other reasons, but we did a lot of measurement of electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah, so parts of the studio are actually clad in mild steel tin plate, which which can effectively screen down to quite a low frequency. It can even screen mains if you, and you have to join all the plates together and they're all earthed. And we put that in because there was a chance that something might come down the road directly outside. The booths are adjacent to the street, and we'd already found some hum from a cable in the street. So putting sheet steel in was quite a job, because you have to put it basically onto the base slab before you build any finishes, obviously. And again, you've got to, you know, remember that if it does have to bridge across, you need some sort of flexible joint in it. But everything, once, if everything's earthed, all the steels were earthed, all the steels were joined to the piles in the ground, and then all the steels were earthed to things like window frames, and then they were earthed up to the lightning conductors in the roof. Everything was joined and bonded together to avoid any sort of hum loops, or and to give very effective screening from hum and noise from outside.
And of course, the
lightning protection as well, of course, because we didn't want to get struck by that.
Yeah, nobody wants
the same thing.
But of course, the point about all of this plant is that it's got to go somewhere, and it was an extraordinary amount of stuff that's required that you have to put in. You've got to allow room for all of that equipment, and that's not to do, you know, not to mention the chillers that chill the air and the water that we use to circulate around it. It's a phenomenal amount of actual equipment, and connecting it all up, it was quite an installation, I have to say. So this is one of we wanted to have light in the studio as much as, you know, daylight as possible. We wanted to have a connection. There were a lot of sort of esoteric, if you like, aspects. We weren't just putting a space up. We wanted it to feel, you know, comfortable, relaxing, all of that kind of thing. So getting daylight was an important part of that. And, of course, you have to have triple layer of glass to maintain the right amount of isolation. So that's how these ended up, and that's how they ended up in the roof. If you look carefully, you can actually see the three layers of glass in there. I don't know if it really... You can see by the banding on there that that's where it is. So now, we mentioned the floor, the isolated floor. Well, the difficulty is you might be able to create a vacuum, but how are you going to maintain it for many years?
One set of glass is attached to the inner skin, the roof of the studio, and the other set of glass is attached to the outer. It's actually a roof light on the outer roof, actually. Yeah. And then there's an sheet of glass in the middle, which is actually still attached to the studio side.
So that's very effective. Yeah, very effective. So this is the beginning of the floor slab process going in. In the foreground, you can see these cut arrangements. And what's going to happen is underneath that is a spring. They're going to lay all those out in a grid, like this, and then they put all their reinforcing rods down, and then when all that's done, they pour what's going to be the floor slab of the studio.
With a separating sheet of polythene down as well.
And then when it's all gone or set, then they're going to raise the whole thing up by 25 mil. They go around, I don't know how they do it.
There's little jacks. Sleeves come up through the slab, and you just go around and turn them all, and the whole thing comes up
slowly, comes
an
up.
Inch, and then...
And then at the end of that, I mean, you can see there, I think there are probably 70 or 80 springs there. The whole thing is sitting on those, and that provides mechanical isolation from anything. We like to think that you could drive a train down the street and you wouldn't hear the rumble inside. And if you look, you can't really see it very well in this light, but at the top there is the floor that's already been cast for the control room, and there is a gap in the middle. They don't touch. And, of course, when we laid the wooden floor on top, there's a break in the wooden floor. And when we put the booths in, all the floor and the slab is broken all around there, so that when you have a booth shut, the sound can't go between the two.
And it does work. There was a man in the street outside with a pneumatic drill, and we didn't hear him in the studio. Mm-hmm. They carried on working, so that was pretty good, I reckon.
So there it is. Finally, the floor went down. Great day that was. And you can see that above there's some other structure going up. We also wanted to, we're concerned, obviously, the studio is situated in Britain, the climate there in the winter is pretty cold. So we thought in the studio area, because you rely on air conditioning, the circulating air to provide heat and cooling, that we would put underfloor heating under the floor, so that in the winter months, you know, hot air has a tendency to rise and stay on the ceiling, cold air tends to sink to the bottom, and left to its own, there's no real... incentive for it to circulate. So we thought that we'd put heating under the floor, and that way we could have a temperate, even temperature on the floor, which would be comfortable. Because we figured if you're in an orchestra, you're sitting there for 3 hours, you know, and your feet are cold, you're going to lose your concentration. And on the other side of it, in a very hot summer's day, if you had a lot of people, perhaps you have 40 people in the studio, and it's a very hot day outside, we worried that if we wouldn't have enough capacity in the air conditioning system to deal with that, so this system will also cool, which is quite an unusual concept, or it seemed to be an unusual concept at the time, so that we can use the floor as a giant heat soak away all the excess heat if that's necessary. So there's the sort of physical side, and then of course obviously we have to address the acoustics of the environment. And once we'd Dave and I had laid out the dimensions of the rooms and how it was going to be laid out, we handed it over to Munro Acoustics, who then came and measured the response of the building and each room in particular, and then devised a series of boxes, absorbers they are in fact, to correct them.
Mainly low frequency absorbers faced with a heavy material which box with rock wool inside, and they place them all around randomly, and then in a studio you don't really need so much treatment as you do in the control room, because the control room's got to be left to right accurate, as accurate as you can, and also front to back accurate in terms of bass. So you do need to tune the control room. In the studio you just need to take the worst of it out and then play from there, which is what we did. We put loads of absorbers up, and we actually left the finish off until everybody was happy with the sound of the room before we put the cloth on, which you'll see a bit later on.
That's the big recording area again. You can see that the whole wall is covered with absorbers of one sort or another. I mean, I think what they do is they calculate what frequencies and by what amounts they need to reduce or absorb, and come up with the required number of boxes to do that. They're all starting to go in, and then there's a sort of a framework that goes in front of that. And eventually that takes the cloth finish, which is obviously acoustically transparent, to allow the absorbers to
nearly acoustically transparent.
And that's the sort of, we're getting towards the end of the build. I think we'd aged about 20 years by then. And we decided that we would have, in the main area, we'd have some variable acoustic treatment so that we could change if necessary. We could dampen down or liven down the room, not by a huge amount, but we had quite a large area to play with, and we wanted a very simple mechanical solution. So we came up with these white panels you can see here, and in that position they are in their absorbent phase. They're absorbent on that side. They just simply flip over and become reflective.
So behind that one, for example, there would be a flat, shiny surface, and then behind the cloth to the right would be an absorbent surface, and there'd be an absorbent surface on the box that swings. Yep. And so in that position it would be absorbent, then you flip the box over so you're left with two shiny sides. That reflects the sound, and it makes, if you can get quite a large area that you can change over, it makes quite a difference to the sound.
Obviously, and we wanted a low-tech solution because we didn't want anything that would break and be very complicated.
So you can just flip those over with your finger.
At the high level, you can see we've got some panels. They're actually aluminium face panels which are motorized, and they open, and when they open, they expose an absorbent side, and when they close, they're reflective and are bright. So they're on two faces of the studio, so you can see there's quite a large area that you can bring into play. And we did that because, obviously, under that long booth, and if all the booths are in play, there's quite a lot of glass that comes into the equation. And we wanted to, we thought we might need to compensate for that when we actually started using the studio. There's a cross-section of that.
One of the upper veins. And they turn on electric motors, but they're a bit flash, aren't they?
And, of course, the black line that you can see in the middle, that's a deadening, special deadening material, so the thing has no resonance and is not going to rattle or do anything nasty. And then it's simply acoustic foam behind that, and then finished with some cloth to make it look attractive when you deploy it. The speakers, we wanted to hang them. Obviously, we had a very big window, and then above the window we're going to put speakers. So they have to sit very accurately. They're suspended on compliant mounts. They have to sit very accurately at the correct angle, both horizontally and vertically.
They're the ATC 300s. Yeah. And we wanted them to be really heavy so that when they hung, you know, they would have a very low resonance. So, you know, they wouldn't vibrate around with the bass. Mm-hmm. And we also didn't want them to couple into the big sheet of glass below the window because you just get distortion. So, and we also wanted to mount them flush because if you mount speakers flush, they perform the best. So it's all set at a steady 12 degrees. And then at the top there, you can see the springs. We could adjust the angle of the speaker and the angle that it faced into the room. So we've got left, center, right of those. And each one of those is encased in a mild steel box to add the weight to bring them up to 400 kilograms each speaker. So each speaker box is 400. So we've got three of those and then two subs. So we've got five times 400 kilos hanging off one steel beam across the top. And then they're completely isolated, flush mounted, don't vibrate with the window, don't vibrate on the wall, just vibrate on their own. And hopefully there's enough mass there so that they won't move about when they're being driven hard. That seems to work quite well. We get nice bass and it's not rattling everything in the room.
And of course the rears speakers we wanted to have in the large size monitor as well. So we had to devise a way of suspending them because obviously a big speaker like that, you can't really put it on a floor stand. The floor stand's going to get in the way and it's a very, you know, bit of a dangerous situation. So in the end, I devised this, it's a dolly that sits on a railway kind of device, and we can slide it.
It's got a little curved track.
Arms there are designed to hold the speaker again at the correct angle, and then the curved track means that as you track it round, it's always maintaining the correct distance from the listening point. And in fact, late in the day, we had to modify it. You can see in the middle there, I think there's one bolt, and the whole thing swivels on that bolt because we had one producer who didn't want all the speakers coinciding at the listening position, so we could splay them out if necessary. I have to say that we've never moved them since we set them up in the beginning. They're just where we left
them. They will go from 110 degrees, which is the British, you know, the European standard, right round to 150 degrees. Yeah. On the track and still maintain the correct distance. Yeah. And the correct angle from the listening position.
And it's all fully calibrated so we can set them at precise angles. And you can move them with your finger. It's a lovely, lovely system. And of course in the background you can see now we've moved away from the mechanical construction of the building, the treatment of the rooms, where now wiring is heavily going on. There was a phenomenal amount of wiring that had to go in. It's incredible, really, just how much wiring we put into the building.
We tried to simplify the layout that between the two control rooms and machine rooms, which is a little separate machine area, we've got a little machine, is the central machine area, and we've coupled all three rooms up with computer flooring. You know, computer flooring, raised flooring, so you can just drop wires in underneath, come up where you want to in the separate areas, and it links together quite easily. So each control room basically backs onto the central machine room, so hopefully it's easy to change wires about. The power supplies are in there, the A to Ds and things. And all the wiring's under the floor, which is all level with everywhere else. There's no thresholds.
If you've got... So you've got the same level of floor throughout the facility. Did you have to do anything special with the door frames so that when the door is closed, there's no opening between the bottom of the door and the floor?
That's an interesting thing. There's a drop-down door seal.
Right.
So as the door closes, there's a pin on the back of the door by the hinge.
Yes.
So as that pin strikes the frame, it brings down a rubber door seal, which closes down onto the floor as the door is just at the last minute as it's about to close.
Oh, it's a nice
option.
So
it seals, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's completely sealed. And then we've got the normal BBC-type magnetic seals all round the doors.
Yes.
And hopefully, you know, there's no gaps so the sound doesn't get through. But they're drop-down door seals. I'd never seen them before. The actual guys found them, the guys that did the woodwork and built the doors, and they work really well. Not had any failures. They sometimes stick, and you can adjust them very easily. Just turn the knob.
Yeah,
it's really clever, actually.
All right, fine. Thank you.
So obviously with the wiring, we wanted to have a very clean mains installation. We had a company called Westwick come in, and their solution was to introduce what they call balancing transformers. Essentially, you feed your mains in, goes through a toroidal transformer, and converts your 240 volt, say, live and 0 volt neutral, and gives you 120 volts on each leg, and that's deemed to be noise cancelling.
It works like a mic cable.
Yeah.
So the center is earthed, and then effectively the two strands of the 115 are out of phase, so they don't radiate. In theory, they don't radiate hum, but you've still got 230 volts across the two wires. The center's earthed. You've got to be a bit careful because obviously it's non-standard, and we had to have it specially agreed with the installers that we could do it. And it seems to work quite well. And we've also got, we've done it to the lighting systems, which are also DC controlled. The blue thing here is a DC lighting system, so they work on dimmers. They're on DC lighting, so hopefully they don't radiate any AC either. So Mark can get his guitar and walk around the studio, and hopefully doesn't get any hum on it. And this, actually, the balance mains does work very well. It's difficult to get used to, and it's difficult to install and get it working. But it does actually reduce the overall noise level of the studio in many ways, that any noise and any interference that comes through the mains is cancelled and drained away through the earth.
Good, okay. So that's all that. Wiring and installation. Lots and lots and lots of wiring. Amazing amount of wiring. Some of the machine room going in. We have a central machine room so that, equipment common to both studios can live in one place. And
you always need far, far bigger wiring ducts than you think. You work it out in your head and you think, oh, we need that space. Well, the best thing to do is double it. And the same with the racks. We thought 14 racks would be easily enough. We've been there 5 years, and it's nearly full of 14 racks of gear in that central machine room.
Some things were a challenge to install. We've got EMT 140 plates, and we had to find a space to have them in the studio, and B, physically, we had to get them in. And also, we had to make sure that if they ever went wrong, we could get them out and replace them. And although the opening there isn't finished, there is a door in that through which the plates do fit, because we did have a plate fail. Had to change it, and fortunately we'd made provision for that. The desk was a monster, came in 56 boxes and one Allen key. No, I made that up, but it was a fantastic thing, amazing to watch the guys put it together, the guys from Neve. Took quite a long time, I think all of 3 days, and when it was done everyone was very happy. We've sort of, part of our philosophy that we wanted to retain the best of the old technology with obviously the modern techniques, and so we're very lucky to have a good collection of Studer 300s, 800s rather. So
24 tracks and 16 and an 8-track 2-inch.
Yeah, and we as Dave says, we run them either in 24 track or sync to 48, or we've got 16 track heads. As a result of working on the project with Jeff that we'll touch on later, we acquired a set of 8-track 2-inch heads, which are phenomenal. And at the end of all that blood, sweat and tears, we had quite an interesting studio. We've got two control rooms, in fact.
An API in the second room, a second-hand API,
yeah,
which is there. But the monitoring is exactly the same. It's just the room is layout is slightly different, and it's very slightly smaller than the other control room. Obviously, doesn't have the big window in the front, so it was easier to control the bass and get that right.
Yeah.
It's got a small recording area with it that I went with Phil from Munro's, and we actually modelled the reverberation time of a favourite bedroom that he had, where he did a lot of voice vocals and a lot of guitars. Modelled it on that, popped it in there, and he loves it. So, and that's got variable acoustics. It's got the same panels that are soft or hard. You can flip round. He does a lot of production in there before he moves into the big room with all the musicians.
And so that's how the live room ended up, which, as you see, quite a nice space. That's actually the very first session that we did. You can see we hadn't quite finished all the cloth on purpose, but we wanted to see how the room performed before we committed to putting the final finish on.
Nice without the cloth on, didn't it?
Yeah, maybe we'll take it off again. One of an early sessions filled up with musicians. obviously the purpose of the studio ultimately is to record music. So it's always a thrill when the place is full of people and it sort of really comes alive at that point. And
you get a surprising number of people in there, and it still stays live, you know, with the help of those panels. Yeah, that mic there is a Decca Tree. It's got three, in that case, it's got three old M50s, which seem to be the favourite mode of recording orchestra. And that one, it's got the BBC Coles 4038 on it, because that was actually a brass session, brass band. But usually, you know, the Decca 3 has for about the last 50 years been used with three Neumann M50s on. Seems to be the standard orchestral recording method invented by Decca, by Wilkie at Decca in the 50s.
So that was the process of building the studio. The rest of this is to do with, you know, particularly projects that we've done, including obviously the main one that we did with Jeff. Obviously, for that particular session, which for those who don't know, Jeff came up with the idea of re-recording Sgt. Pepper's with contemporary bands, but on as much of the original equipment as we could lay our hands on. And for that, you can see in the foreground the Red 51 desk, which was a 50s design desk, I think built in the early 60s, we think.
62, ours is 1962.
62, and...
It's the Beatles' valve desk. It had been switched off for 30 years. There it is. And
may I just add something?
Yeah.
I just say that in French.
Oui.
Le projet était en fait une commission de la BBC pour faire initialement une émission de radio et une émission de télévision, donc pour commémorer les 40 ans de l'album Sgt. Pepper. Donc ils ont en fait réenregistré tous les morceaux de l'album avec les techniques de l'époque et le matériel original. Alors il y avait deux options, où on récupérait les consoles là où elles auraient dû et puis on remettait tout peut-être à Abbey Road, et puis l'autre solution, vu qu'une des consoles était déjà là, c'était de réunir le matériel à British Grove et donc de faire ces séances. Donc elles ont été réalisées avec le matériel et les techniques de l'époque, et donc c'est ce que Jeff aussi va pouvoir parler après tout à l'heure. I was just introducing why the project. Alors, ne me posez pas la question de pouvoir acheter le disque ou d'avoir le DVD. Ce ne sera pas publié parce que ça poserait trop de problèmes de droits d'auteur avec les artistes qui ont réenregistré. Ça restera probablement dans les archives de la BBC. Il n'y a pas de DVD de prévu de tout ça. C'est dommage, mais voilà, c'est comme ça. Il y a des séquences qui sont accessibles en ligne. Il y a sur notre site de réalisation quelques petits liens YouTube sur les séances qui ont été faites, dont on va parler tout à l'heure. Il n'y a pas pour l'instant de projet de faire un projet commercial à partir de ce matériel. Et c'est dommage.
How much tweaking did the console need after waking it up after 30 years?
Well, we know a guy called Brian Gibson who was at Abbey Road with Jeff and myself in the 60s. And he's... Sorry? Pardon... Oui, bon, merci.
It's an audio show, it's okay.
So Brian actually was quite an expert on that desk, that particular. He came and he totally took it apart and completely rebuilt it, recapped it. It did actually turn on, and he didn't have to change every valve. And in fact, what was extraordinary is the fact that it's old plastic wiring in there, and none of it had degraded. When he cleaned it all up, it looked as shiny and clean as the day it was new. The desk, it turned on okay. The broken bit were the meters. They'd suffered a bit with age, and all the pots and the stud faders all worked. They just needed cleaning up. And he took the whole thing apart, and he's actually taken quite about 100 photographs of the whole thing, actually.
More like 1,000.
Of his restoration. Yeah. It's a marvellous piece of kit, and it's in use all the time. People come in just to play stuff through it, just to add it to their sound, as well as being able to record whole sessions. And Jeff came in and very bravely did a whole album on it, and it was fine, wasn't it, Jeff?
Yeah.
And when you look at the design, when you look at the design of this thing, I mean, it was designed 50, 60 years ago, and it's basically the same signal path as modern consoles. It's got EQ, it's got mic level, it's got pan pots, it's got echo send returns, it's got track switching, it's got faders. You know, it's not automated in any way, but it it's incredible the way they were thinking then and the way they think now. It's basically the same thing made now, 50 years later, except that one's all valve. E88cc's and EF86's in the main.
And the EQ that it has, they had in two versions, and they come in these cassettes units that you can see there. The one in this picture is a classic EQ, and the alternative was a pop EQ. And the rumour was that the classical guys didn't want their EQ being sullied by any pop people, so...
The only thing that was different was that but they were both worked at 5K. The pop is a 5K peak,
yeah,
5 kilohertz peak, and the classic is a 5 kilohertz shelf. So, you know, they get more HF for the old classic boys who are probably half deaf anyway.
But we like to think that the first plug-in EQs...
Yeah, they're real plug-in.
So that was that. Of course, the tape machines we used were old Studer J37s.
J37, these two that we got back, we hired from... One came from the Studer Museum in... Well, I think actually it's in Boreham Wood. And the second one came from the guys who run AMS Neve. They bought it from the sale of the Century. Ken Townsend ran the sale of the Century at Abbey Road a number of years ago. And those were the original machines that were used on Sgt. Pepper, and all of the Beatles stuff was done on those one-inch four-track machines, completely valve. And Brian, again, came in and made sure they were working. They weren't too bad. The heads were pretty good. They needed a few valve changes, as everything does, because the valves go off and they get noisy. But in the main, they were fine. One was a lot better than the other. I won't say which one. And, you know, he did all the recording on it, didn't you, Jeff? And that's Richard Lush there, who's worked on a lot of the Beatles stuff at Abbey Road, originally with Jeff and ourselves when we were there. He now lives in Australia. He's been a bit ill, but hopefully he's getting better.
And also... other equipment we had to assemble. We had to find microphones from the correct period. So, is it D19 we found. That was the drum kit set up.
We borrowed some mics from the AKG Museum very kindly from Vienna.
And we borrowed some tea towels from the kitchen. It's quite good. They let us have them.
There's a D20 from... That's from the AKG Museum in Vienna.
Yeah. We were very lucky with some of the equipment. There's Jeff at work.
This here is a little passive four-way mixer, because it only had 8 inputs, of course. If you have 8 inputs, everybody wants 12, don't they? And if you've got 12 inputs, they want 16. So that was something that we had made at Hayes. We had several of those where you could plug in 4 mics and bring it up on one mic input channel. Obviously, they were parallel, but at least you got a bit of passive fading between them. And you could mix them rather than, use up mic inputs on the desk. So that actually gave you 11 inputs instead of 8. 12 inputs. My maths is really good.
And in the background are pretty much all the effects or outboard equipment that was used. Right on the top, the green unit is a Altec compressor. Did you have 1176s in the day?
No.
So they weren't particularly... typical, but the one at the bottom is a Fairchild.
Yeah, the 1176s were the nearest we could get to the Altec for sound here. Yeah.
So not too many compromises. Lots of consultation went on, and we had quite a few bands. It's the Brian Adams was in. I think in a later bit we'll play a bit of the DVD, I guess. So just to see, in the background is another desk. We actually, for this session, we had 3 desks in the room. It's a fairly unusual situation, which gives you an idea of how big the control rooms are.
That's an EMITG desk which replaced actually the 51s in about 1970, and that's one that we've got there. Well, funnily, amazingly enough, I remember bringing one over. The first one we ever got, we brought to the Salle Wagram here in Paris and used it for about 12 weeks on classical opera recordings. So that was the first TG that Abbey Road ever had. Then it went back and went into one of the studios. But sort of... The last Beatles record to be made on the Red 51 was Let It Be, which was actually released after Abbey Road, which was the first Beatles one to be made on the TG desk.
A bit more things, some random pictures here. Men at Work, Stereophonics came in.
how much did you explain as regards to what the project was from the BBC? Did you say that it was we would take like 14 of today's top bands that we used to use in Pro Tools and so forth? Did you talk about that?
No, I didn't. So the
project that we took into British Grove was a directive from the BBC. And the idea was, it was the anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper album, and the idea was to get 14 of today's top bands who had been used to using Pro Tools to get them in and give us one day to do each track using the original equipment. And then I knew that British Grove had all this original equipment, and as Dave's explained, you know, we got the original microphones that I used, i.e. the D20 for the bass drum and the AKG D19 for the drums. And also the Tube 40, we did have Tube 47s, didn't we?
Yeah, 48s.
Yeah, because I used 48s and 47s on the guitar amps on the original album and on the vocals. And we had a C12, Tube C12 on the bass guitar, which I had on Sgt. Pepper as well. So that was the sort of directive. And, you know, the first band came in, which I believe was the Kaiser Chiefs. And they sort of started off, and they did, you know, they were used, you know, didn't, I don't think they realised, we were also recording analog as well onto 1-inch 4-track. And I don't think they realised we were going to do it in that fashion, because there was some sort of miscommunication with the producers of the show and the various bands that came in. So they came in and they did like three or four passes of the basic rhythm track of Getting Better. Yeah. And it wasn't very good. And
being polite.
Yeah. But what transpired from that was they, you know, it's all filmed and it's on footage. I don't know whether they have time really to show it, but they discussed it and said, well, we're not very good, are we, really? Because what they'd been used to doing was to do three or four passes of the basic rhythm track, and the Pro Tools operator would make something of it. Mm-hmm. So that was their standard. But then, so we said, well, you can't do that. So then they wanted the cameras shut off, and they had a band meeting. And then they came back, and I think we must have done like 18 more takes of the rhythm track. And to actually see this footage, it's more like, I don't know if you're familiar with Spinal Tap, but this is actually like Spinal Tap for real. And as you see the progression of the way we made the song, it's quite incredible, and they come out with an incredible version of it. And three of the bands that actually came in to do their songs, actually, when they went back to do their new albums, actually reverted back to working on analog. They realised, well, it was good instruction for them. Yeah, and that's when we did Lovely Rita with Travis, and they liked the sound of the acoustic guitars under the stairwell. And, you know, I'll try anything. I mean, nothing's impossible. I just sort of, you know, do it. And it did sound good. So that's how we recorded the acoustic guitars for Lovely Rita. And also on Lovely Rita, there's the comb and paper sound, which sounds like a kazoo. But they wanted to use the real comb and paper, which they did. And so everyone tried their hardest to make these tracks work. So that was the sort of premise of the whole situation. And of course, using ADT, which we used a lot on the original Beatle recordings, which was automatic double tracking, which was lifting off the sync head or the replay amp from the multi-track machine and putting it in a tape machine to delay it or advance it. And you could only do that on remix or when you did a tape-to-tape. So you could actually put the copy vocal ahead or behind of the original, and that leads on to where?
That's sort of the end of our kind of studio construction phase. We could run some of the Peppers if you want.
Run some of the film.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk more about doing it? I mean, I'm just trying to think of incidences that sort of happened on those sessions.
Yes,
getting back to the Pro Tools situation, you know, there was a band called Magic Numbers who did She's Leaving Home. And they are harmony singers. And again, the two girls that sing, I put them in the vocal booth to start singing their harmony parts. And it transpired. And when I was listening to it in the control room, they weren't singing together. You know, the words weren't starting or finishing together at the ends. And there were double S's and double T's on the words. So no one had sort of instructed them about this. Well, only one of you sing the T or only one of you sing the S. Otherwise, if you don't finish together, you've got a double T or double S. And to watch each other's mouth movements while you're singing. So again, what had transpired, when they'd done their harmony vocals on record, they'd gone into Pro Tools individually and the Pro Tools operator had put their vocals together. But there was no way we were going to do that. So it actually took about 4.5 to 5 hours with them to learn those parts. And they were so grateful afterwards. I mean, one of them was nearly in tears. And they were just grateful for the fact that no one had shown them how to do it, you know. So all these things that we were doing on these sessions was, you know, teaching them and helping them, you know, even to be able to perform live, you know. Just it was just this is the way that we, you know, we're working now, you know. And to me, you know, music and whatever we're going to record starts on the studio floor and not really in the control room, you know. That's just a method of recording it or enhancing it. And if it's not right on the studio floor, then you've got no
thing. It gave them a real lesson of what you have to do. Yeah. When you first is you have to know how to sing properly.
Well, sure.
And the technical won't cover everything.
No, because you know with tuning devices, if I'm producing or doing a session, I won't use a tuning device. The singer has to go and sing it in tune, which is normally quicker anyway, you know.
Yeah, I was talking to several colleagues and friends about the Kaiser Chiefs.
Right.
And how surprised I was that this is a professional band, one of the hot bands,
right.
And you're going, they can't even play together for 3 minutes, a simple tune. Yeah. And then people are coming back saying, but they are supposed to be great live.
Right.
And I'm going, well, I wonder how live they really are.
Yes. Yeah.
But when you're doing a song that you've done over and over again, they can do it almost automatically with their eyes shut, facing backwards, standing on their head. But when they're doing a song that they've never done before with an engineer they'd never met before in a studio they'd not before, and he walks in and says, by the way, you've got to do this now and you've got to do it right from beginning to end. They possibly never even played it before.
Well, so, I mean,
it was quite a thing for them to do.
Yeah,
I think that's...
Yeah,
they were surprised how we used to record compared with how people naturally do it now, and it's a lot of it's done for them in the control room, as Jeff said.
Yeah. I was just wondering, you know, having followed the various presentations with Peter and Jeff, as to whether it was a decision not to inform the artists that they were going to do it, so it was like going to be like a shock, or whether, you know, I mean, how much prepping up did they actually have to do or were asked to do before actually arriving at the sessions?
They knew. I mean, as I said, there was some miscommunication because on the Sergeant Pepper track, which Brian Adams sang, the reprise of Sergeant Pepper at the end was by the Stereophonics. Mm-hmm. And the Stereophonics thought they were doing the big version of Sergeant Pepper.
Oh, okay.
So they came in and had to learn the end part. So there's a bit of miscommunication. But they did know in advance what they were supposed to be doing, and they, I guess, assumed that they knew the track anyway because everyone knew Sergeant Pepper. But knowing
is one thing, but being able to play it live, like Dave says, yeah. I mean, if you're real, you play every evening, it's different.
Yeah. And one of the other great tracks that came out of it was Fixing a Hole, which The Fray did, and that's a beautiful version.
Jeff, can I ask you a question? What was it like? You've recorded now, since you did the Beatles, you've gone on and you've done recordings all over the world with different mixing desks and different formats. So you've got used to a new way of working, right?
Yeah.
Then suddenly you get thrown back with that old gear, having to think back 30, 40 years. You looked as if you just dropped straight into it. Did you drop straight into it? Or did you have to prime yourself and work and think about what I have to do and... Or did you just did it come naturally again?
No, I didn't.
Like riding a bike,
I didn't, because, I mean, I'd been operating that mixing console from 1963 through to 1968. Well, I don't know,
when we swapped.
And it was a figment of I thought the sounds that I knew came from that Red 51 desk, were they, you know, was it a figment of my imagination?
Mm.
Did those sound, or, you know, did I just think they were that great, like the guitar sounds and the drum sounds and so forth? And then as soon as we lifted up the fader, when we started to do the drums and the guitars, it sounded exactly as I remember it sounding, which was really great. And that was down to that EMI mic amp, wasn't it? And it wasn't the Telefunken amp.
No, it was the EMI.
Because that's right, yeah. So there's a lot of confusion. Was it the Red 27 or the Red 50?
Red 37.
Red 37 is the one with the Telefunken amps, right?
Yes.
Which hasn't got the punch that the
the EMI ones had, because that red, the one with the Telefunken amps was in number one Abbey Road, wasn't it, for the classical?
Yes.
And sometimes when we'd go down there, but not very often, I know the reprise of Sergeant Pepper was recorded in number one, but I know because it was such a, you know, a huge studio and we had to build a studio within a studio to make it dead. But if I ever was recording down in number one on other projects, I couldn't get the same impact that I could from that desk. And I didn't at that time know why. But anyway, all the switches and so forth, I mean, as I said, we're working on that desk for so many years and coming back to it, you know, so many years later, within like 30 minutes, I was just quite, you know, without even thinking about it, just doing, moving all the dials. And it was very, very easy. Yeah.
That's amazing, yeah.
And there was just an anecdote, which I noticed on that desk when Dave showed it, and I've just remembered it. There's two large pots up on the top corner, and they, whenever that was, I remember, because we were really not allowed to, yeah, those, we were not allowed to actually know much technically about how things were made, that we weren't allowed to get involved with technicalities at EMI. It was a bit regimented and things. And those two pots up in those corners were like their first attempt at surround sound, and no one could ever figure out how that worked. You could actually pound something in a circle.
They were some indifference, yeah, resistive.
No one had ever done it.
They called shufflers, so you add a bit of difference and a bit less sum, and it goes from mono to outer phase, and you can actually use them to do a 360 degree sort of.
No one had ever used them.
Nobody ever
used them. They were never dreamt up
in the lab.
And we knew nothing about them, you know?
EMI made several models of mixers based on this basic design. They did a stereo one, which was called a Red 15. Then they did the Red 37 using Telefunken and 40 dB line amps. Then they did the Red 51, which is this desk, which is the Beatles' desk, where they use their own 40 dB line amp. So it's a standard 40 dB line amp throughout. And they either, the ones Jeff was referring to, they've either used the off-the-shelf Telefunken amps in the earlier models, and then they used their own design amps in the later one, the Red 51. Mm. That's how that came about. So although the desks look very similar, they do sound different with different amplifiers and different mic pre's.
Yeah. And getting back to a lot of the sort of Beatles sounds, I mean, when we first started, you know, when I sort of started recording them, when we were doing Revolver, I mean, there were no plugins, and the only way I could, because they were quite demanding in what they wanted sound-wise, because they were fed up with just listening to sort of the regular wishy-washy sort of Cliff Richard and the Shadows type sounds. You know, they wanted sounds with more impact and so forth. And that's when I started to alter, change the mic technique. But the only way I could get different sounds really was to abuse the equipment, which was not really done. And I mean, one instance, really a simple one, was the bass drum microphone, whereby the rules said you couldn't move it nearer than 18 inches to the bass drum because the wind pressure would damage the mic. And I actually did move it in to get a more solid bass drum sound and took the front skin off and stuffed something in the bass drum. And someone sort of snitched on me and I was in trouble. But there was a meeting and then there was a letter written that I could actually do that, but only on Beatles sessions. But then everyone else wanted to do it. So it was gradually gradually breaking down barriers as we were going. But as I said, to get these sounds, I was overloading the mic amps in the desk possibly and overloading the Fairchild, which was my only sort of, you know, golden thing that I had really, and because I used to put all the ring, everything that, you know, were in mono, and all the drums went through the Fairchild as a mono drum set to get that sort of ring, what we know as that sort of sound now, I guess. But I was just limited, so I was, you know, just being demanded to do stuff by them and just trying to abuse the equipment, you know.
So we in moving the D20s nearer into the bass drum, of course they got louder, so they used to break more often.
Yeah, well.
And they were very well, you couldn't mend them, you had to put a new capsule in. So I actually made a mic using a speaker, an 8x5 elliptical in a box, and put that in front of the bass drum. But then when management heard about that, they said, oh, no, that's not a microphone, it's a speaker. You can't use that. So yeah. I had to put it in the skip.
Yeah, because I used the speaker on when we did Rain and Paperback Writer. As my being naive and young, my theory was, well, if a bass amp can push the bass out, you know, the loudspeaker can take the bass
exactly,
back
it's
in.
It's exactly the same, Jeff.
Right,
yeah.
So I used that as a microphone on Rain and Paperback Writer, and it was hard to control because I think I went in one compressor and sort of held it a bit and then into another compressor and out of that compressor into another compressor and just to get it solid. It was really hard to control, but it just suited those two titles. It was sort of impractical to do that in those days. But now it seems that I know in America that most people on their sessions have either got a speaker and a mic in front of the bass drum and also in the bass cabinet.
So in those days also, you only had two mics on the drums, which is what you ended up with in British Grove, except you might have had a 56 on a snare occasionally.
Yeah, they were
but it was usually a D19 and a D20.
Yeah, because Norman Smith, the original Beatle engineer, he used the which is now the Coles 4038 overhead, and again, because of the discussing drums, because I was a mastering engineer before I was a recording engineer, and I was listening to a lot of American records come in, because we used to remaster the American records for the European and English market, the Tamla Motown records and so forth, were remastered in England. They weren't the original American records. So there were sounds that I was hearing, and you know, the Beatles were hearing these sounds also on American records, so they wanted more impact on the drums. So I then switched to the D19C, which was basically the cheap talkback mic from the mixing console. And I know in some pictures we would just had the one overhead, and then there was the snare drum mic, and there must have been a hi-hat somewhere, and the D20 on the bass drum, and I guess we had more D19s on toms. We must have done. And it was only later that I think on Day in the Life we were lucky enough to be able to put the mics under the toms, as well as the top of the toms and so forth.
But then that would use up mic inputs on the desk, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and as Dave said, through that little pre-mix, you know, we used to put the four little drum mics, well, if they were tom mics, through the four faders and through one fader and just EQ it. And it was only until we got to the TG desk to do the Abbey Road album that I could actually record drums in stereo, because by that time I think we were on 8-track, weren't we?
Yes, 8-track.
Yeah.
So that we went on 8-track in the middle.
Yeah, and that was
a
luxury, you know, drums in stereo for the first time, you know, because there's no mono version of Abbey Road, it's just stereo. And everything up to that point, again, the protocol at EMI was that everything, we were behind the times in stereo, and everything was monitored in mono at the time of recording, which was one loudspeaker, the one out of the right, which made it extremely hard to actually record and get sounds, because it's easy to get one guitar left, one guitar right, you know, you've got definition on both. But when they have to come out of one one sound source, you're looking for a tonality, and you want to put the guitar in its special place, and it mustn't clash with the other guitar that's coming out of that same sound source, i.e. being the loudspeaker. So it was really hard, and sometimes we had the luxury of time on Beatles sessions, because most of the songs were composed instrumentally, you know, the instrumentation of the record within the confines of the studio, and in some cases, you know, they only came in with a half-written song. So it gave me the luxury of time to be able to actually, you know, alter the sounds. But sometimes it took like 2 hours to get the distinctive sounds between two guitars with the limitations of the EQ we had on the desk. So it was a combination of that, some outboard EQ, and the equalisation on the amplifiers. And if that still didn't work, I mean, I didn't really take note of what guitar maybe John or George was using. That didn't interest me. I was just listening to sounds and tonalities, and I just say, well, I'm having problems. Can you just change to another guitar to make it a bit more trebly or bottomy? You know.
Yeah, most of the time, the Beatles would come in the studio with no specific idea of of what they would be willing to record this day. So maybe they say, well, okay, John, do you have something to play? And then John would play a song, and eventually the others would say, and then you had time to experiment, and that is and also the arrangements more or less were built in the studio, which
they
gave you a bit of time
to
practice the equipment and to experiment the the gear.
I mean,
fact, the time you didn't have when you redid Sgt. Pepper, because, you know, you didn't have that time. They came in away they went.
No, that's right.
Well, put the red light on and off they went, you know, because that was the time that Jeff had limited to do the recording in.
Yeah.
Are you going to play some material or not?
Have a look at a bit of that.
It was not planned.
Yeah, the BBC put it out. It went out on television only. This was never released as a...
And the radio.
An album. Was the whole thing on the radio?
Both sides.
Well, so I play the intro before that.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of introduces the project.
Right. This is the start of the TV programme.
I can pause it and move
which
it
is
on.
Very informative.
Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Autre radio, autre culture.